Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.
It's the fighting. It's the fighting. Clock. It's the fighting. It's the fighting. Clock.
Oh, that was really interesting, mate.
Welcome, fellow nerds, to another episode of The Extra Inch. And before we start the podcast proper, just a bit of admin. You might have noticed through the way you're listening to this that we've got our own feed now. We've got our Extra Inch feed. We're our own entity. And we were featured this week on iTunes New and Noteworthy, because we're both new and noteworthy. Please do subscribe to the feed if you're not already. Follow the Twitter account, The Extra Inch. Leave us reviews. We've had two so far. Thank you to Dave Forrest, which is a real name, I think, and Shamin Charizard, which I suspect is not. Dave Forrest said, the older and more mature brother of TFC, great insight into tactics and the inner workings of the game. TFC is the pre-match burger and The Extra Inch is the Michelin star restaurant, both great but in different ways, which I enjoyed very much. Thank you, that's very sincere, Dave. And Shamin Charizard says, thanks from your monkey brother. Always a quality pod and respect to you for setting off on your own path. Looking forward to listening to some cracking insight and most importantly, that's coys for come on you Spurs. Cheers, monkey. I like the fact that he used my tagline, but I was very confused by the name and the monkey references. Anyway, we've had 9 iTunes ratings so far, mostly 5-star, but 1 4-star and 1 1-star. So I think we can probably say that the 1-star was from Miguel Delaney. Please do rate and review if you like what you hear. If you don't like it, it'd be better if you didn't review us. We don't really want any more 1-stars. But yeah, 5-star reviews would be great. Anyway, my name's Windy, and as ever, I'm joined by my sidekick slash best friend, Bardi. Hi, Bardi.
Hi, Windy.
And our tactics guy, Nathan.
Hello,
or
mate.
Nathan A. Clark, as he now calls himself. And this episode, we're delighted to also have two guests here to talk about football journalism. Firstly, Jack Pitbrook, the journalist from the Independent newspaper. Hi, Jack.
Hi, mate. How you doing?
I'm good, thank you. Your second appearance?
Yes.
Good to have you back on.
Hoping not to get second podcast syndrome.
Yeah. And we won't be talking about VAR this time, although I think Bardi wants to ask about that later. And we've also got Dan Kilpatrick, the Spurs correspondent from ESPN and co-host of the Tottenham Way podcast. Hi, Dan.
Hello, mate.
And I think the last time we were on a podcast together was when we were in the back of my car recording after a youth game.
Correct. You shoved your phone in my face, pulled out into a lay-by, and started talking about Luke Amos.
It was I spotted your talent
very
early.
Very exciting.
I spotted your podcasting talent early. I think you, it was before you started the Tottenham Way.
It wasn't, possibly, no.
Oh, right, really? Was no. It the early days of...
It would be the early days of the Tottenham Way, yeah.
Nice. Well, we're all here to talk today about Spurs in the context of football journalism. And we're going to start off with... we're going to try and go a little bit deeper than the usual chat about journalism. I kind of want to get into the mechanics of it a bit. So to start off with, we're going to touch upon press conferences and how it all works. So as someone who's been to Hotspur Way, but only to watch a match, I can kind of describe the layout as you turn up. It's basically very green. There's very nice, freshly mown lawns everywhere and nicely planted beds and things and lots of Spurs branding and logos. And there's this kind of windy path up towards the centre the Hotspur Way Centre, and you go in and there's this kind of almost like a hotel reception, quite a fancy reception area with big screens on the walls, and there's kind of seats for you to take a seat there, and there's a coffee machine and stuff, and it's all very normal. What happens after that? Where do you go for the press conferences?
So next door, next to that room is a small auditorium where they hold the press conferences. So these are press conferences which are more or less before every match, usually at lunchtime. And the way it works basically is Pochettino comes in with usually Simon Felstein, the club head of communications, head of press, and Jesus Perez. And then the whole thing will last for more roughly half an hour.
Yeah, it's half an hour to 40 minutes, yeah.
So the basically it works in two sections. The first section, which lasts about 15 minutes, is the stuff which is broadcast more or less live. So that will start off usually with questions from Sky Sports, sometimes from BT Sport, radio, Web Press Association.
Yeah, I mean, anyone can chip in, but generally it's led by Sky Sports. BT, maybe BBC, will follow them, talk sport occasionally. And then, yeah, often the Press Association will ask questions at the end.
And that's the stuff that that's the stuff that is broadcast on Sky Sports News immediately afterwards and gets tweeted straight after. So when you see quotes on Twitter coming about like sort of 1 or 2 o'clock on an afternoon, so you'll see it. I mean, I don't know when this is going out, but there's one tomorrow afternoon. That's all from the first section of the press conference. And then once that's done, they break. All the cameras and recording equipment get turned off, and I'd say about 10 or so people from newspapers and some websites go up to the front and have a more kind of informal discussion with Pochettino. And all that stuff will be published usually at 10:30 that evening. And then, of course, be in the next day's newspapers. So the embargoing stuff until 10:30 is basically a... It's so that the newspapers have their own content, so that they have stuff which isn't immediately published, isn't immediately online, basically to kind of protect their uniqueness or to protect their own hold on the occasion. And generally speaking, it's more interesting, that stuff, because it's more of a kind of back and forth discussion with Pochettino. I think, frankly, the standard of questions is better.
Yeah, and I think it's fair to say that when the cameras are off, Pochettino is a lot more comfortable.
He's more relaxed.
He's more
funny.
Relaxed.
He'll tell anecdotes.
He'll be much more willing to turn to Perez and say, "This is what I'm trying to say. Can you translate it for me?" He'll be much more willing to take his time over a question. Whereas when he's got the camera on him, the Sky Sports camera, he knows that they're going to be clipping that up immediately and going out. So, yeah, occasionally I feel like he might not understand the question and he'll just go for it, give a generic answer, whereas in the press briefing or dailies briefing, as it's called, I think he will be much more prepared to listen to the question, give a thoughtful response.
Would you guys ever ask a question in that first part, or even if it's pertinent to what's being talked about, or would you always hold back and wait for your part?
No, I'd always hold back and wait for my section, because you know that if I ask him a question that first bit, then whatever he said would just, like, everybody would know it instantly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's better if you can kind of, so, and also, like, you're not meant to ask questions in both sections. Like, you're either meant to be part of the first section or the second section rather than both.
Yeah, I think being part of ESPN, that can be, you can straddle both. So sometimes I would ask a question in the first section, but most of the time I'll stay quiet because I know that there's better stuff in the second briefing and I might have a question ready. But then I also think generally the second briefing, it is for the daily newspapers, so you want to, I tend to leave them to start it, and then I might chip in toward the end if I think there's a lull and there's an opportunity to ask something.
So will Sky and BT stay for your section, or because they can't use it anyway, it's embargoed?
No, they don't stay. And the other thing I'd say about the split is I think the broadcast section, the live section, is generally for news. So you might ask him about kind of team news, Spurs form, you know, his opinion on VAR, something like that, like for a newsy line.
Yeah.
Whereas the later section, you want to be putting the kind of flesh on the bones, as it were. So if he said something of interest, then it's a chance to go deeper and say, well, you know, you hinted at this in VAR, or you mentioned your relationship with Mourinho, you know, can you expand on that now? So I think they do work well in tandem together, but equally they're very separate briefings.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that he's kind of a bit less guarded in that second section when the cameras are off, and he knows it's not going to just be put straight onto Sky Sports News. Does he let his guard down fully, or is there other times when someone has to step in and say that's crossing the line, we don't want you to ask these kind of things?
Yeah, so that's a good, like, there are, I'm trying to think of a good example.
I've got one example, if I can interrupt.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember there was one time where Poch was asked about Donald Trump, and Simon Feldstein just very politely said, a reminder, this is a football press conference. So it's not a free-for-all to ask Poch whatever you want. It's about football. It's a preview of the next match. He did, I think, talk about the Catalonian referendum, but then that's relevant to him because he's lived in Barcelona, he's got a home there, he's managed Espanyol. But you can't go in with something wildly off topic and expect that he has to answer it, because he doesn't.
He talks about
football. Yeah, it's on his terms.
Interesting. And do you kind of, are most of the questions asked in that section fairly kind of generic mainstream questions, or do people ask about the quirks of the club and the smaller things that people wouldn't necessarily think are big headlines?
I think generally they're not that quirky. Like, the questions usually we'll have a bit of a chat beforehand saying, you know, what should we ask him about today? Should we ask him about a particular player or a particular issue or a match or an anecdote, that kind of thing? So, because obviously if you've got, you know, like, it's generally there'll be 10 journalists there, it lasts about 10 minutes, it's much better to have quite a few questions along narrow lines than to have 10 different people with 10 different ideas asking one question each, because that way you can never really get into a rhythm. So it's one of those tensions where, on the one hand, people have gone there with different ideas, but ideally we'll all end up with fairly similar with similar pieces that we write, because otherwise you'll, like anyone really, Pochettino is much better at getting into a groove where he's talking about one topic rather than doing like 1 minute on Dembele and 1 minute on transfers and 1 minute on youth players, that kind of thing.
So I imagine you guys must all get to know each other quite well, because you're turning up at these things constantly. So is there kind of like a group of you that are in quite regular contact about press conferences and trying to arrange, like you say, these kind of almost successional questions where you're following up on one another's points? Or do you have like splinter groups where there's different groups of journalists?
It's like the people that go to Pochettino will use press conference will usually be drawn from a pool of about 15 to 20 people. Yeah. So you generally know everyone who's there. There's no formal organisation. It might just be a very informal chat beforehand. You know, what are we going to get him on today?
But it is a very collective effort, I think. But obviously, you know, I'm a beat reporter and that I only cover Spurs. Maybe the Times will send someone that will cover several clubs, and being a national newspaper, they would want to get Pochettino on something a lot more that's going to get in a national newspaper, yeah. Essentially, so maybe his view on VAR, maybe Harry Kane's future, maybe his future. Whereas as a beat reporter, I would tend to think, you know, what are the fans interested to know, you know, maybe in Kudu or something, which, let's face it, isn't going to get, you know, be a back page spread on a national. So you always have different agendas, but on the whole, it's a funny old profession, because essentially the people you're kind of competing against for kind of views and mm-hmm. stories and all this kind of thing and access are also they're kind of your rivals, but also your colleagues, because it is such a collective effort. And you always get better stuff when you work together, when you've got a plan, when you've got a theme in mind. If you go in there, which does happen sometimes if you just don't have a chance to prep, if you go in there and kind of, you know, throw in lots of different questions from different angles, is generally when you end up with quite a bitty transcript and something you can't really work with.
I think Dan's right, that there is a really interesting kind of tension there between the extent to which you're both colleagues and rivals with the same people. Like, I see... You know, I see Dan more often. Like, my closest colleagues will be people like Dan Dave Heitner at The Guardian, like Jeremy Wilson and Matt Law at The Telegraph, because they're the people that I see almost every day, whereas other people who work for The Independent, I speak to them every day, but I don't see them as much. And so there is very much a kind of like collegial feel, I think, between all the journalists who cover the same clubs.
That's really interesting, and the stuff about the embargoes is fascinating as well. I always assumed that that was the reason for the embargo. It was kind of almost protecting the craft of print journalism, and I do wonder whether at some point that will change, because
it just also means that, I mean, the standard and quality of journalism would drop without embargoes. Mm-hmm. Because if it was just, oh, we've spoken to Harry Kane, who can write that fastest and get it out, then people will go for speed over quality. Mm-hmm. And actually having a set, you know, okay, we spoke to Kane, that's for tomorrow night, you know, you've got a day to write it, and you know, you've got a day to make calls, speak to people, you know, put together a really good piece of journalism with those quotes as a framework, or working around those quotes. I think in Spain, I'm right in saying they don't really have embargoes.
Yeah, I think embargoes are quite an English thing. I think my very personal opinion is that I don't think the 10:30 embargo will last forever, just because not like normal people aren't looking for Spurs news online at 10:30 in the evening. And that's
not just Spurs. Nathan's grinning.
That's true of other things as well. But you know, like everyone knows that web traffic correlates with office hours, and that generally speaking, that's when you're best off publishing stuff. But I do think that having a separate section which isn't recorded by the cameras, which is only for journalists from newspapers and respected websites, and which isn't published immediately, is incredibly helpful and important, and does, like Dan says, produces a much higher quality of content than the kind of like the first section of the press conference. And it would be, I think, we would really lose out if we didn't have that separate section.
When you, I'm quite interested in like when you go into the auditorium, can you ever, there's a big story brewing, can you ever sense that there's something about to kick off, like if there's a big topic on the horizon?
I mean, I remember when Danny Rose did the interview with The Sun on the eve of the season. Mm-hmm. Spurs were very clear with us when we were asking for a response that Pochettino would address it at the next press conference. And so I remember everyone was tremendously excited, and there were loads of people tweeting me, being like, where can I get a live stream of this press conference? Yeah. And I was like, it's not live, you're going to have to just wait. So that was the only time I've ever gone in there with a real sense of expectation, because you just didn't know how Pochettino was going to react to that, and he might have, you know, really condemned Rose, and he, I thought he handled it really, really well in the end. He just very much played it down and said, yeah, we've moved on, and so in the end it was a bit of a dud. Mm-hmm. but I think not really. The most explosive sort of press conference was when Poch announced his new contract, and that was completely out of the blue, and I don't think anyone had that story. He just said, oh, I've got something to say, you know, I've signed a new contract. It was toward the end of the first title challenging season.
15-16
right?
Season.
Yeah.
That would have been when he moved from head coach to manager.
Yeah, when his job started to change. And yeah, I can't say that there was a kind of atmosphere when he came in or anything. It was just, you know, business as usual. And then suddenly, oh, this is a big story.
I mean, on a professional level, I know you're a Spurs fan, but do you ever wish that Tottenham had like a Nigel Pearson in charge, that you could go in and your interview or your conference could get serious national headlines, and there'd be a lot
of
interest
about it? Well, I mean, Pochettino does make national headlines because he is the manager of Tottenham, and he's such a, he's a great football manager. But speaking to some of the guys like Ben Pearce, who's done the beat job for a long time, I think nearly a decade,
mm-hmm.
That's what it was like under Sherwood. If you speak to Ben, he'll say, you know, every week you went in, and Jack, you may have done some Sherwoods. I didn't. I mean, he said every week, you know, you went in, you knew it was going to be something explosive, and just some, you'll be struggling to pick out the best bit at the end.
Yeah, completely. He would always, you know, he'd shoot from the hip and tell it like it is and all that stuff. But obviously, I don't want to get into a long discussion about the merits of tactics, Tim, but he would always, like, when you do that every week, it loses its effect, because you just, and I think at first people were like, oh wow, it's amazing, he's so quotable, but eventually, like, it's just kind of, when there's a soundbite, well, there's so many soundbites every time, it does lose a bit of its effect. Whereas now, if Pochettino hammers someone, like for example Guardiola, over the Harry Kane team comments, that was like a massive deal because it was, you know, one of the biggest managers in the country taking on the most famous manager in the world. So I think Pochettino like picks his moments much better than Sherwood, but because of that, his words carry, and because of his superior record as a manager, his words carry much more weight.
Interesting. I think we've sort of covered this to a degree, but we had a question from Jackie Lenkelis on Facebook who said, are there any topics that the press know are untouchable and would put your spot in the room at jeopardy if brought up? Have you ever seen anyone ejected for asking a particular question or escorted from the premises?
No. I mean, I just go back to what I said. It's not a free-for-all to ask Pochettino anything about his marriage or whatever, you know, or Donald Trump. It is a football press conference.
I think if somebody asked something really obviously inappropriate, they would get told they weren't welcome back.
Mm-hmm.
But I honestly don't think I've ever heard of that happening. Like it might have happened without my knowing, but I don't think that's ever happened. I think generally speaking, people know what is and isn't okay. Sometimes you might ask something and they'll say, we're not going to comment on that, but I've never heard of anyone asking something which has got them banned.
Didn't we have a newspaper banned from attending Spurs matches for a while under Sugar? Was it even Standard that wasn't
that
allowed?
That rings a bell. I remember Alex Ferguson banned lots of papers from Man U over the years, but I think you're right. I think it may have been Evening Standard.
I think it was something to do with the Sugar.
No, that's news to me. I mean, Newcastle have done it fairly recently with the local papers.
Mm-hmm.
Under Ashley, it's not unheard of. I think Spurs are actually, I mean, this whole discussion, and it should say in terms of the wider discussion, I didn't really have any basis for comparison because I only do Tottenham and beat reporter, but I do think Spurs are very inclusive. Like I think it's fair to say, Jack, that some clubs are a lot more restrictive about who can go in the daily section, the separate briefing, whereas Tottenham are very much, they're very, very inclusive as a club, and they're very good about getting people involved, getting you access to manager and players.
Yeah, another thing I'd like to say on that actually is that Tottenham are really good in terms of the amount of time that the second part of the press conference with Pochettino lasts for. That is, at Arsenal, the equivalent sort of daily section will usually last for kind of 6 or 7 minutes, whereas at Tottenham we usually get 10 to 12 minutes.
Yeah.
Which is much better as well. And also, like, the fact that you know it's going to last for 10 or 12 minutes means that it has a more relaxed atmosphere from the start, whereas at Arsenal sometimes everyone's a bit, like, in a rush to get their questions in.
That was the kind of next thing I was going to ask you about. Are you ever kind of fighting with people to ask you a question? I mean, when I've seen press conferences on TV, it's never felt that way. You always hear kind of a voice pipe up in the back of the room. Is there like a pecking order as such where you know who's going to ask what in what order?
I'd say, go back to what I said earlier, in the broadcast section, if you put your hand up and make it clear to the press officer that you want to ask a question, you'll normally be able to get it in.
So he invites you to speak.
Yeah, you know, you'll just catch his eye and say, yeah, I've got one, and he'll say, okay, you next. You know, he'll mouth it and make it clear that you've got your question at some point. In the separate briefing, as I said earlier, I think it is, you know, kind of traditionally and really for the daily newspapers, so I think it's best to let those guys lead, but then sometimes as it's a team effort, so sometimes you'll have an idea that's in line with their theme, and so yeah, you'll kind of interrupt or go for it.
It nerve-wracking at first when you first started going to these.
I don't mind saying that. I think the first time I asked Pochettino a question, my heart was racing and I was quite nervous about it, about it sounding like a tit.
Yeah.
And then once you've done it kind of once or twice, it's
just becomes normal.
You just get used to it, and it just becomes a norm and obviously part of your job.
You know, because could you ask Mauricio Pochettino a question from me and Windy about his son and whether or not his son is ever going to make it at Tottenham?
See, that's probably the kind of question that's sort of slightly border on randomly inappropriate.
But he's a footballer. He's playing football for
Tottenham.
How
do you phrase that question? Is your son any good? Not really.
What do you think about nepotism?
To be honest, it's not actually the worst. It's not the worst question in the world.
No, he's never
talked about it. But I mean, yeah. Again, I'll go back to what I said earlier, which is that you do have to think of the collective sometimes as well. And if you're going in with very obscure, you know, if I really wanted to get, 5 minutes of Poch on kind of Luke Amos, which Windy, I'm sure you would marinate in. I would be really screwing over the national journalists who, frankly, couldn't give a stuff about Luke Amos. So you do have to factor that in, I think.
Do you need a minute? You're right.
I need a minute, yeah. I mean, that would be crack to me, but look, there aren't many people that would enjoy that line of questioning. So I'm sort of moving on to more broadly your relationship in general with the club. Presumably, so when you first start working with Spurs, you're assigned that club as part of your job, you make contact with them, you kind of ask for access, and then what happens? You get given the number of the head of the press team, and then you kind of have a chat and try and forge a relationship?
Yeah, so the Tottenham press team, so Tottenham have, I don't know, sort of maybe three people, I think, who engage with journalists sort of day to day. They're all very good. Their job basically is not their only job, but one of their main jobs is answering questions. So that, you know, it's fairly easy to get hold of them by email or on the phone. If both for like what you might call organisational questions, like when's the press conference or the game or how do I get accreditation, that kind of thing, and then also information, like you will have a lot, you know, if you've got a story about Tottenham that you need them to comment on or that you need to run by them, or if you've got a question like an injury update or what's happening with the stadium or that kind of thing, you know, you'll go to them and then they'll give you an answer. So they have a few different jobs to do in terms of their relationships with journalists, but I find them very professional and good to deal with.
Yeah, likewise.
We had a question from Lee Batiuk on Facebook, who said, is everything planned perfectly in terms of statements around injuries, transfer policy, stadium, etc., or are they sometimes economical with the truth? Do you get a particular
feel? I think
there's
a bit of a fan's misconception that, like, the clubs give out information in order to, like, for example, the club give out information on transfer targets as part of some big kind of formal organised strategy to make themselves look good or to sell tickets. People always say, oh look, there's a story about Tottenham trying to sign whoever because it's season ticket renewal day, that kind of thing. It's bollocks. Like, that isn't how it works at all. That isn't to say, like, there is obviously strategy there in terms, like, they are thinking about what they want to say and when, and on things like the stadium, they'll have a clear idea about what information they're going to give out under what circumstances. I wouldn't say that with things like transfers there's any kind of great string pulling operation.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I think one of the biggest misconceptions about journalism is that you get fed a steady stream of information by the club, which just isn't how it works. Like, I think if you go to the club with information that you have from another source and say, look, I've been told whatever, so-and-so is being sold or so-and-so is not going to play again, you know, this is what I'm going to write, so I've been told this, then they will say, well, okay, look, can you just play down
one element?
Yeah, well, this element or just for your information, yes, that's true, I don't mind saying that, but this is why it's happened. If you approach them with info, then they will brief you. They're not, you know, calling me up and saying, oh, Dan, just FYI, you know, Danny Rose isn't going to play again this season and we're going to sign Neymar for... But, you know, it doesn't work like that. So we don't get kind of drip-fed information. Occasionally, of course, you do get an email or a text message saying, you know, just for the record, seen a lot of these type of stories and, you know, that's wider the mark. But I say that's actually pretty rare. And again, I'm just dealing with Tottenham, but it's pretty... Yeah, infrequent. So most of the time it's journalists coming to them with information and then the club responding rather than the club kind of being on the front foot and saying, we're going to give you this information or we're going to tell you this thing or that thing.
When Sky uses the term Sky Sports understands or there's a source close to the club.
Sources.
Who are these sources, and who is that person close to the club? Is that just license for somebody who's writing an article to be able to kind of guess, or is there actually someone that you have to have proof that if they're called up on it, they have to show who it is?
Yeah, I don't think they'd be guessing. I think that particularly with broadcasters, if they will be speaking to the club press team fairly often, and they will be getting the club line on a particular issue. And so if they say, and it's not just, I mean, there's like a particular criticism that people make of Sky about them ripping off newspapers, but putting that to one side, I think if you say, whether it's Sky or BBC or whoever, mm-hmm. saying a source close to the club says X, it is going to be a source close to the club. They wouldn't make that up or falsify.
I mean,
that.
We have to do that on ESPN, which, you know, I don't mind saying, it can be quite frustrating, but if we're doing a story that isn't in the public domain,
mm-hmm.
or that we've found, we have to say either sources plural, or if it's a singular source, we have to give a bit of information on the source, so a source close to the player, or source close to the situation, or close to the club. Just because ESPN's a big kind of global news organisation, and they want accountability.
Yeah.
So you do have to specify that. And you know, on the rare occasions that I do it, it's not kind of, you know, made up from Twitter or an internet forum. It has to be kind of legit, because if the bosses in the US came to me and said, okay, you know, they wouldn't say, what's your source, but, you know, where's this from? Is it from, I'd have to say, yeah, it's from someone who knows the player or is aware of what's going on.
I've also got a question for Jack, because I saw you tweet something when Arsenal lost to Bournemouth, and you went hard on Arsenal, you properly called them out, and it was just like, I was quite surprised to see someone give that kind of opinion. And were you angry? What kind of license do you have to put your personal opinion when you're just reporting?
Yeah, it's a good question. I wasn't. I think you have quite a lot of license. I think nowadays, I think particularly with a match report, like, people don't read match reports now to find out the details of the game. Like, even for example, Tottenham Newport on Saturday, which Dan and I were both at, nobody would click on our reports being like, oh, I wonder what happened. Oh, wow, Harry Kane scored with 8 minutes left. Just because you kind of know that. Like, it's,
yeah.
You would have seen it on Twitter or...
comes up on your phone.
Yeah, like, however you get your news, you will know that Harry Kane scored a tap-in at the far post from a corner. And you'll probably know that, like, Spurs were rubbish in the first half as well. So I think a match report has to convey something of, like... I think the reporter has to get across his opinion. I think you have to convey what it was like being there, what you felt watching the match, any, like... analytical insights you might have, or any other bits of information you can work in. Like, it's got to be a more, like, considered, well-written piece than just like, and then after 55 minutes Heung-min Son came on and his first touch was to set up Dele Alli, that kind of thing, because ultimately no one's going to click on a match report for that kind of detail.
Yeah, I did at NCTJ now, it must have been about 8-9 years ago, and when I was doing the sports reporting thing, we had to write match reports, and it was pretty much a blow-by-blow piece. And then you have to quickly kind of sum it up at the end. But yeah, I guess you're right that how people digest football now has completely changed.
Yeah, completely. Like, I think that's just a function of time and technology, ultimately.
Mm. Going back briefly to your kind of tirade against Arsenal, Jack, was there a kind of risk when you were doing that of creating a tension between you and the club in terms of a longer-term relationship there? Or have you ever felt, like Dan was saying, he contacts the club saying, I'm going to write this story... Have you ever felt kind of that you've really pissed them off, that they're, you know, it might be because it's true and they don't want anyone to know that it's true, or they feel that you've gone completely off piste and they just want to shut it down and they're not happy with you?
Yeah, I mean, there's always, you can't keep everyone happy in this job, and often stuff, you will upset clubs with what you write. Either, I'd say it's generally either if you've got something wrong, which makes them look bad, or if you've got something right, which they don't want to be public. I'd be very, very surprised if a club got upset about a match report, like just saying Arsenal were shit, because, like, it's kind of, I mean, it's obvious if you watch it. But so, like, generally with that kind of match report, like, I wouldn't expect, I mean, I didn't hear anything back from Arsenal, I didn't expect to, but the times where you do hear something back from a club, whether it's an angry, a bollocking on the phone or a text or an email is because they think that you've either like got something wrong or you've sort of overstepped the mark.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think also clubs are well aware that you've got a job to do, you know that they've got a job to do, and you're both aware of each other's positions, really. And I don't think clubs ever want to tell you how to do your job, and equally you never want to be speaking to a press officer and saying, well, this is what you should be doing. And often, on the rare occasions that there has been some conflict either way, I think it's usually forgotten kind of the next day or the next press conference. It's these things have quite a limited kind of, the annoyance has quite a short shelf life, I would say.
Yeah, football moves so quickly, like people, everything gets forgotten very, very, very soon because there'll be a news story the next day. And
so you don't think there's a dossier, a Dan Kilpatrick dossier in a box file somewhere where they just...
I mean, I really hope so.
They printed off every good story.
I'd love to think that Levy's got a kind of specific file on his computer about me, but I think it's highly unlikely.
He's got some dodgy photos.
just in case he ever needs to use them. He says he followed Dan. We know this. I mean, it is interesting though, isn't it? I do like the... That idea of this tension between club and journalist, where sometimes you might know that they're lying to you, and it's just a case of saying the right thing. Do you think they just don't? You think they generally play the straight back?
I honestly don't think clubs lie to you, really. I think they can be selective with what they tell you, but I think it's quite rare that or they simply won't know. The person you'll be speaking to, you know, isn't the person deciding the transfer target. We haven't got a direct line to Levy or Pochettino himself, or at least I don't.
Must be quite deliberate on their part, that they're feeding the press, head of press, only the information that he needs to know at that time, so he can't lie to you ultimately.
I think like people in that job, and this isn't unique to Spurs or even to football communications, like you do benefit from a degree of plausible deniability.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's not like they don't, you know, no one in that kind of job would know everything. It's not really in their interest to know everything. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So going back to the transfer window and such, like, how does this time of year must be absolutely chaotic for you guys? How does a story about a big transfer will come together? So, for example, and I'm genuinely not trying to call you out, Dan, but obviously you've said yourself on the Fighting Cock that you sent this tweet about Lucas Moura saying that it's not happening. You'd obviously been told it's not happening, or at that point there wasn't anything in it, and then it does seem to be happening potentially, and you've now come out and said, yeah, there's definitely something in that. But how does this whole story come together, and what was the journey there?
I think Jack should probably answer this, because for instance with Kyle Walker, he was the journalist in the country that was very much on top of that story and got everything right, and I've not really ever done that in my career, like had something from start to finish. On the Moura thing, and I just said it to Flav on the Fighting Cock about an hour ago, like obviously one of the things as a journalist is if you say something's likely to happen, like you know, Spurs are in talks to sign X, Y, or Z, and it doesn't happen, it doesn't look particularly bad. If you say something's not going to happen, it does happen, you look like a massive tit, which has obviously happened.
People don't forget.
You'll hear stuff. You do hear a lot of whispers from agents and whatnot, and you have to make a call on whether that's something you can write, or whether they might have an agenda, or whether it's even true or not. Because while I don't think the club lies to you, I think it's fair to say that maybe people close to the players might do. And you just have to make a call, and journalists do get things wrong, and things do move quickly. So that's part of the job in a way, and I think.
Ultimately you do get things wrong. Like I did a story maybe last week saying Arsenal set to beat Tottenham to signing of Malcolm, and obviously since then Arsenal pulled out, Tottenham went back in. That's probably not going to happen either, so I managed to get it wrong twice. basically. But
at that time, that was...
Yeah, at the time, I think it was... I think what I published was probably fair enough based on the information I had. I think the information was... The information was good, but the situation changed, and that is ultimately... That is just going to happen if you kind of... If you take a risk and stick your neck out, you are going to get it wrong, and we all get it wrong.
I feel like that's sort of the main reason for the mistrust between specifically football journalists and the general public, is that there is an appreciation that situations change, and that there's this idea of if you've said something and it hasn't come through once, well, that's it, then everything you've ever said is nonsense. And I think that is where that sort of borderline toxic relationship comes from.
So I want to ask Jack about the Kyle Walker transfer then. So Dan mentioned that you were on it from the start. What does that mean?
So I did a story, it was after... Trying to remember which, it was on a Monday, the day after. It was after a game at White Hart Lane where he was surprisingly benched.
Is that right? Arsenal or Manchester United, maybe?
Yeah, one before that.
It's one of those games. I think it might be the 1st of April.
Okay.
But yeah, basically a big White Hart Lane game on Sunday. He was surprisingly dropped for Trippier. I'd been speaking to a few people close to the situation. Who knew Kyle, and I got the impression he wasn't happy. And then I had another phone conversation the day after the game, which made me think that, yeah, he does definitely want to go. I think I published a story saying Walker wants to go. He's asked Pochettino if he can leave at the end of the season, likeliest to go to City or United, I think was how the story came out. And that was one where, obviously, what, you know, the events that followed kind of confirmed my story, but equally sometimes, you know, it's conceivable that events could have gone differently. He could have found an agreement with Pochettino, and then I would have got lots of Spurs fans on Twitter calling me a nonce, which I get anyway. You are always at the mercy of events, basically. And Malcolm is a good example of the opposite thing. Like sometimes what you write will be proven right, and sometimes what you write will be proven wrong, and it's just the way it goes.
So in your career, when you're kind of building up this list of contacts who feed you their bits of information, how does that come about? Do they normally approach you, or do you have to try and create scenarios where you're forging a relationship with someone to connect the dots and get that information? So Dan, for example, you're a substantial face, as it were, on Twitter now in the Spurs community. People know you. They know you write very sensibly, level-headed articles about Spurs. Do you get people DMing you stuff?
No, honestly, no. I don't have open DMs, but no one's... I can honestly say that I don't think anyone's ever approached me and said, you know, I'm an agent, I'm a former player, you know, it'd be good to chat to you. But then, I think... No, very few people are going to pick up the phone to you when they don't know you and just start telling you sensitive inside kind of transfer news. I think it does have to be a relationship that you build up over time. So, you know, for instance, you might be doing a feature on I don't know, let's say you're doing a feature on Tottenham's young players, and then you call up someone who knows one of the young players and says, you know, how's so-and-so doing? You know, oh, that's really encouraging. You know, what do you think of their future? How have they been managed? And then from there, you know, that's a start. You write positively in the piece about the player based on the information you have. And then that's the start of a kind of relationship with that person. And then a few years down the line, the player's in the first team and you've got a contact there, you know, someone who's close to them and who trusts you and who knows you're not trying to kind of mug them off. It's not like I can just pick up the phone and say, oh, you know, Harry Kane's agent, please. What's, you know, how much is he being paid? What's the latest? You know, it doesn't work like that, I think. It has to be more of a kind of considered relationship over time.
Yeah, that suddenly makes a lot more sense, because I was always struggling to kind of think how you bump into these people. I mean, I know from going to Hotspur Way to watch under-18 matches that you will get lots of agents hanging around. There are people on the phone who are clearly talking about their players, their clients, and they're trying to build relationships with people around the outskirts of the match. So it's quite obvious there is stuff going on there. But aside from that, I've always wondered how you kind of create those links. But of course, it makes sense that when you're going to, I don't know, a shoot for Nike or something, and the player's there and you're getting 10 minutes with him, that of course his agent or his people will be there with him, so you get an opportunity to meet them. That suddenly kind of falls into place.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Rebag, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermès, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
So sort of going back to the craft and your training as such, where did it start for you guys in terms of your roots into journalism?
So go on, Jack.
I started by writing a blog about the team I support, which is not in fact Tottenham, but Manchester City, which I wrote when I was at university, so like 2007, 2008, 2009.
So you're a blog nonce as well.
I am a blog nonce. Unfortunately for me, that got read by a man called Simon Kellner, who is a big Man City fan and was then the editor of The Independent. We got in touch, and then I came in and did some work experience, and then I got a job at The Independent off the back of that, starting in 2010, so about seven and a bit years ago, which is really fortunate because, you know, I was lucky that my stuff got read by someone who liked it and was in a position to help me out. But unfortunately, it's not really a path which other people can put much faith in, just because it kind of relied on a massive slice of fortune.
Well, weirdly enough, I was also had a blog, and I think Jack's the only other person I know that got in that way.
Michael Cox.
Oh yeah, yeah, that's true. So I mean, I had a blog called The Tottenham Way that, I mean, honestly, I don't think it was anything special. It was like quite newsy. I wanted to create a place that kind of aggregated all the news and quotes about Tottenham, and then also a place where I could do my own features, you know, whenever I was frustrated or I had an idea or something came into my head. And I did that. I was doing some teaching. I did that, and I also was like freelancing for kind of BT Sport and Goal, and I wasn't really thinking about a serious career in football journalism. It was just something that I quite enjoyed doing. And
were trained as a journalist, weren't you?
I did broadcast journalism. I did a diploma. But I was, by this point, by the time I got the ESPN job, I was actually thinking more in terms of like the business side of it. I quite liked, you know, I don't know, the marketing. I was leaning toward that side, but then this opportunity came up to write about Tottenham, and obviously I had a Tottenham blog, and I think ESPN were aware of it, and it just kind of fell into my lap. But yeah, apart from Jack and Michael Cox, I don't know anyone else who went in that way, so I think this is quite unusual that we both got in via a blog.
Well, if I'd known that, I wouldn't have got you both on, but a bit of variety would have been nice, guys. But seriously, did you do the NCTJ, Jack? Or is that...
No, I don't have any journalism qualifications at all.
So I'm the most qualified journalist at the table.
Well, Dan's done the NCTJ.
Well, I've got a diploma.
Okay.
Have you got a master's?
But no, not in, okay. Not in journalism.
Okay. We're equal.
Yeah. We have an alarm set was sponsored for all.
But for people who are listening and they want to get into it, I do recommend doing NCTJ, because you learn about the craft, you find out things, you study, you get the public law and all that kind of stuff. So it is a way for people to get into it. And my tutor he was a proper old school journalist who used to work for the Mirror, slick back hair, kind of shiny silver suit. And terrible, terrible man, like, I think, outside of work. But you learn a lot from him.
You know, I'm going to disagree with you. I don't recommend doing it.
Okay.
Really?
Yeah. I'm glad I did, because I probably wouldn't be where I am now without it, and I very much enjoy my work. But I think if you are really wanting to get into journalism, rather than paying to do a master's or a course or a degree or whatever, you will learn more in the same space of time if you literally go and if you get any opportunity to, you know, go and make tea at the Independent, or, you know, run around the ESPN office and listen, work hard. I do genuinely believe that, and that wasn't the way I did it. But then I came out of my diploma, you know, having a good idea of how to write a news story and, you know, do broadcasting bits, but still not quite aware of how the industry itself worked, the stuff we've been talking about. So I do think there are different ways of doing it, but I personally recommend people just try and get in any way you can to a proper news organisation.
And the other thing I would say, I mean, I'm not a journalist by any stretch, but I do, it strangely happen to work with a number of journalists in my day job, and they have all said the best way to learn is just to write constantly. So whenever you have a moment, just write, follow a news story and write a feature about it, submit it to a local paper or a blog or whatever, and just hone your craft out over time and get feedback from people who know what they're talking about.
And go places and do things, you know, don't necessarily go to a Premier League game, but go to a women's football match where there might not be many other reporters, or go to a youth game, you know, as I know you've done, and write a report from it. And, you know, there's so much football media now, and there's so much interest in the professional game and clubs like Tottenham. You know, if you did go to a youth match and started writing insightful reports on the under-18s, I think you'd quickly find that there'd be websites that would pay you a small fee for that information, for that insight. So you have to get out there, I think.
Absolutely. So we've got a couple of other questions. That firstly, from Dan Rattigan on Twitter, who said, when it comes to transfers, does anyone from the club talk to the press in a wink-wink manner, no need to name names, or does intel come from other sources, agents of the clubs? Is that different to... And he means, is that different to other clubs? So are Spurs different to other clubs in that club? We've kind of covered it, but I am interested in this, how clubs vary with this. Is the way that Spurs handle the press identical to the way that other clubs handle the press?
No, I think different teams have different operations. Like, you can kind of... It's kind of to do with resources. So big clubs like... So I'd say that City, Chelsea, Arsenal, Man United all have really big press and media teams. Even amongst those, some might be more... I mean, I don't think I'm giving too much away here to say that, like, City have quite a sort of proactive press team who are... They're really... I think they're very good at their jobs at kind of getting good stories about City out there. Whereas I think, say, like Arsenal and Manchester United maybe have a slightly more relaxed attitude. Like, they're probably maybe a bit less busy when it comes to, like, trying to set the agenda. Because they know that the club is so big that they don't have to be in journalists' ears that much, because they're, you know, if you've got 2 billion fans on Facebook, you're maybe less dependent on what's in the newspapers.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think I mean, I know there is one big club in the Premier League that will kind of text the local journalist if they're announcing a big story like a contract or a transfer, and just say this is embargoed and until this time, and to give them the head start. You know, Spurs don't do that. So there are big differences, as Jack has alluded to, and kind of little differences with the way they'll deal with things. But I think, yeah, again, I don't think there's a lot of kind of nudge, wink, wink. It's they'll tell you what they can or what they want to tell you in a fairly kind of straightforward way.
And a question from Mark Ward on Facebook, who said, how much of an effect do you think the press actually has on a team's psychology? Which is an interesting one, because sometimes an article written about a club can change the mood, or certainly from a fan perspective it can change the mood. Do you feel that can have an impact internally within the club as well, or do you think that's far-fetched?
It's a really good question. I think I'd be surprised if the Spurs team, or if, I'd be surprised if lots of the Spurs team read a lot of what was written about them. I think Pochettino will be aware of what's about Spurs in the papers, and I think I think, I mean, I don't want to sound Brexit about this, but I think the English players will read more than the foreign players, naturally. But yeah, I think equally, particularly coming up to a big game or whatever, I think a lot of the players, and this is, you know, general to players, will just kind of not read anything so they can focus on the game. But I'd be interested to learn more about that because I don't have a cast iron answer.
Yeah, I think I'm not sure, but I do think obviously the club will use the press to its advantage sometimes, and Pochettino will. I mean, I think the Harry Kane team kind of dig at Guardiola was a good example of that. I think, you know, it served many purposes for Pochettino to get it out there. Like, I think, you know, City were, he still felt at that point, I think, that Spurs were in the battle with City, which now seems a bit mad, but they weren't that far ahead at that point. So I think he was just, you know, trying anything to kind of unsettle them and you know, get in Guardiola's head, trying mind games. I think he also felt that it was also a very good way of getting his other players, apart from Kane, like massively onside. You know, you can well imagine him saying in the dressing room, you know, I'm going to go out there and, you know, make it clear that you're just as important as Harry. And, you know, that would, to hear the players love him, and you can see why when he does that kind of thing. You know, if I was Dele Alli and he'd done that, I'd be, you know, well chuffed. And I think he's aware of that. You know, it's not, and I've also seen it suggested this week that, you know, it was a kind of nod to Real Madrid as well. I don't know how true that is, but there are many different kind of reasons that he might have said that, and I think he was well aware that he was, you know, using us in that case to get several messages across.
I definitely feel that Harry Kane can be quite susceptible to ongoing narratives. I definitely think the second season thing plays on his mind at the start of his second season. I feel like the August thing plays on him as well. I think this August is finishing as well. And that's a very non-analytical sort of view of things. But I do get that sensation with him and his obsession with goal-scoring records, that maybe that stuff plays on his mind.
I think that's a very good point. Yeah, I think Kane, more than anyone, knows what's being said about him and being ready.
Yeah, I agree.
We've also been on the other side of this press, that when after we beat Arsenal, AVB came out with the famous downward spiral, Arsenal in a downward spiral, and then that seemed to almost inspire Arsenal and put us in a downward spiral, which ended up with them finishing above us. But I got a question about audiences. So Jack mentioned about foreign players and stuff. Obviously, with Heung-min Son, he's got massive following in South Korea. Do you ever like change the timings of your tweets or anything? Because like Spurs official will tweet it early in the morning, like 3 o'clock in the morning, to catch a different audience. Do you guys?
No,
do
that never occurred to me, to be honest.
It's never crossed my mind either. No, okay. It's an interesting point, but no.
Start draft.
Yeah, it might do.
Timing tweets.
Well, one more question from me, if you don't mind, just. What's the kind of most regular question you get from fans? Do you get, I presume you both get a lot of tweets from club fans asking you stuff. What's the kind of, is it just things about signings? Is it just when are we signing so and so? Is that the most obvious one?
Yeah, it's apart from the abuse, it's just like.
Do you genuinely get abuse?
No, not really. Like, there's people that will just. I find there's just so many moaners on like Twitter. They're just so negative about everything. So you'll say like, oh, you know, Pochettino said X, Y, Z, and then they'll just whinge. They'll find a way to whinge about it. It's not personal abuse, which is sort of very boring, I think.
Yeah. One thing that you get a fair bit of from fans is whenever anyone reports that a rival team is interested in signing either Pochettino or a big Spurs player, you do get quite a lot of Spurs fans who are like, oh, you're trying to sell our players, you're trying to sell our players. Mm. Which is nonsense. Like, I wouldn't want Spurs to sell Kane to Real Madrid. I wouldn't want them to sell Eriksen to Barcelona, and I wouldn't want Pochettino to leave. Like, I feel privileged to cover these people. But if it's like if the story's there, then you've got to write it. And I don't think it does. That's the one. That's, I mean, I completely, you know, I'm a football fan myself. I completely get how fans conduct themselves on social media, and I'm kind of fine with most of it. But that's something which slightly annoys me, just because I think it represents a kind of misreading of what job we're trying to do. and suggest that I want these things to happen, which I don't.
And I'm in a lucky position that I only cover Spurs, and actually most people on social media know that I'm a Spurs fan, and I do my job in a professional way, but I don't hate the club or anything like that. But I do see a lot of kind of national newspaper journalists who are covering more than one club get accusations of bias a lot, and so many of them now have bias against X club in their Twitter bio because they've just had so many pelters along those lines, and it must be very tiring, because I don't think I've ever met a journalist in the UK media who's genuinely biased against a club. It just doesn't happen.
Have you ever leapt up in the press box when Spurs have scored a goal?
honestly no.
Is that because you're very aware that you have to maintain a sense of decorum?
I think once you get in the press box, I think professionalism does take over and you've got a job to do, and I've normally got report or analysis to write like on the whistle, so you're under a bit of pressure, and I think you do just slip into professional mode. The only time I ever feel really like a fan is like on the way to games. I remember kind of walking to the last game at White Hart Lane against Man U, walking up the high street, and it was such like a carnival atmosphere, and I remember thinking, oh, this is great. But then you got into the press room and like sat down and had my meal, and it was like kind of back in journalist mode, so kind of switched between the two.
Did you feel emotional at White Hart Lane that day?
Yeah, I did actually, but then again I think a lot of non-Spurs fans who were reporting on it did as well, because it was an emotional occasion. And I remember actually going for a little walk around, and I think it might have been with you, Jack. I think we went out of the press room and I had a walk around and everyone was cheering, and I saw a guy in a Man U shirt, and I remember turning to either Jack or Ben and saying like, oh, why is there a guy in a Man U shirt here? And I'd completely forgotten that Spurs were playing Manchester United, because it just felt like there wasn't a game, it was just a kind of farewell ceremony to White Hart Lane. And I suddenly thought, Christ, there's actually a match to play here, and there's opposition fans.
If Spurs go in the Champions League final, would you take the day off work and say you want to follow it as a fan, or would you work it? Because as you said, when you work, you lose the kind of emotion.
Yeah,
of the
that's
game.
A good question. I kind of think I want to work it as well, because as much as it would be good to be there as a fan, I think it is now my job, and it does change you slightly, and I think I would probably be in the away end thinking, oh, I wish I could go down to the mix zone afterwards and speak to Kane when he scored the goal, and and it would see what was going on down there, and I'd want to be working actually.
I think once it's been your job, it's very difficult to go back to like fully thinking about things as a fan. I go and see City as a fan like hardly at all now, like once or twice a season. But when I do go, you enjoy the day out and going for a beer with your mates beforehand and all that. But when you're in the away end, there's always like a big part of your brain which is thinking, all right, if I was in the press box now, I'd have probably written this, and I'd be thinking that, and I'd ask Pep this afterwards, and I think this is the angle for my match report, and this is the angle for my follow up piece the next day. And it's very difficult to like fully roll back into a kind of into fan mode. And so like to take Bardi's question with City in the Champions League final, I would much rather be I think I could probably now say I'd rather be there as a journalist as a fan. And also because like once you try and build a kind of career doing this, you want to be able to write about the big occasions. You want to have that on your CV, like I've covered a Champions League final, rather than I kind of went to a Champions League final, but I didn't write anything about it because I was in the stands.
Okay, because when you started writing your blog about City, your team's changed completely from when you first started following it. How do you feel? Because now you've got arguably one of the greatest Premier League teams that there's been, but it hasn't always been that case. How do you feel about where City are today?
Yeah, that's a good question. Maybe this is the good thing about having a bit of distance from it because of my job. Like, I don't massively care if they win or lose. And obviously, that's a really easy thing to say when they win every game. But, like, my mood isn't ruined if they lose. Like, when you're a proper fan, like I was sort of 10 years ago, I would be my weekend would be destroyed if they lost. Whereas now, I kind of, if they do lose, I think it's quite funny and I move on quickly. So it's not... How I personally feel about City, well... I don't know. I mean, I feel like the change. I feel it's quite difficult for me to separate how I, the change in how I feel about City because of my job, and the change in how I feel about City because they're really good. I suppose like it's difficult to unpick those two things. I do. I mean, like anyone, I think that like the buzz that you get from success is kind maybe slightly diluted by the way that it's rendered almost inevitable by spending £1 billion.
Yeah.
But I mean, that's such a big topic. It's kind of difficult for me to spell out exactly how I feel about it.
Whereas I think as a beat correspondent, you're in a slightly different position. Like you kind of can be more of a supporter than if you're covering several clubs or if you're working for a national, because, and I think it's fair to say that all the ESPN beat correspondents of the top six kind of support their club on the side as well, because it's in my interests for Tottenham to do really well, because if Tottenham do well and get to Champions League finals and FA Cup finals, it furthers my career because I get to go to those events. Whereas I think for Jack, it wouldn't have a huge, you know, Spurs have a terrible season, it's not really going to have a significant impact on your career. If Spurs go out of all the cups at the first round and aren't in Europe, and I've only got kind of 40 games to do a season, I've got a lot less work, I'm a lot less busy, and I'm a lot more bored. So is it really in my interest for the team I cover to do very well?
Could you ever do what Ben Pearce does and cover a team that's not your own?
Well, I can't speak for Ben, but I think he has, I would say he's secretly adopted Spurs.
He's got a soft spot for us.
Yeah, he's definitely got a soft spot.
I thought Ben was a Spurs fan until he told me otherwise.
Yeah, no, he's not. I think it would be very difficult, honestly, for me to do that. Like, I do want in my career to expand and cover other teams.
Mm-hmm.
And I would ideally like to be, you know, either for ESPN or wherever, you know, in a position where I was a specialist on three or four teams, like Jack and other people. But I don't know whether, if someone said to me, you know, can you go and be the Chelsea beat reporter and just do Chelsea, whether I would really want to do that. And then not just Chelsea, but any other club.
Yeah. I mean, this has been such a fascinating insight into what you both do. I really appreciate you taking the time to do it. And at the risk of sounding like I'm just blowing smoke up your arses.
No, please. No, do.
I did sort of want to say thank you for everything you do sort of on Twitter and in your...
You're very welcome,
Windy. ...independent and ESPN. Because I do feel like we're very spoiled by the fact that we've got such level-headed, sensible, talented writers writing about Spurs who were also incredibly what's the word I'm looking for, open to responding to people on Twitter as well. There's never any you never get ignored if I were to tweet one of you or Ben, or if anyone were to tweet one of you. You're very open to communication with anyone, and I do think we're lucky as Spurs fans to have such a good group of people covering the club for us. So yeah, thank you. Is there anything you feel like we've not covered that might be of interest to listeners, or have we done it to death? Any kind of behind the scenes, ITK?
What's the scoop?
Yeah, what's Poch like? We haven't actually asked what Poch is.
Yeah, that's a good question. That's a good question. Yeah, he's really really good. I think that he's best when he's talking about like anecdotes or his slightly like off the wall theories about football, and he's got quite a, like,
it's quite zany, isn't he?
Yeah, he's quite zany, but he's also quite like romantic. At Newport on Saturday, he was telling us, we were talking in the press conference after the game, which was really good because he absolutely hammered the players. Like, he said that the motivation, desire wasn't there and everything. But at the end of the press conference, he was saying, he said, I was worried during the game, but I really enjoyed it because for me, this is like the real football. It's pure passion, like the atmosphere and the pitch and everything. And he is someone who, I mean, this is really obvious if you've like heard him talk or if you've read the book he did with Guillaume Balaguer. Like, he loves these kind of emotional, passionate football occasions. And I think he's at his best in press conferences when he's talking about that, or just when he starts going off on one about, like, oh, there was this one game with Newell's Old Boys, or there's one time at Espanyol, and, like, it was all kicking off, and I kicked someone in the bollocks.
Yeah, when the former player comes out, it's often Poch at his best, I think.
Yeah, completely, because he is, like... I think one thing that you can probably tell from if you read closely the stuff that comes out in the press conferences is he doesn't like going into details about current players. Like he'll hammer the players, for example after the Newport game, he'll hammer the players as a group, but he won't really pick on individual players. And he won't, if you ask him like, how can player X improve this season, or what does player Y need to do, or what's gone wrong with him, like he won't really go into detail because he doesn't like picking on players in public. Whereas he's much better kind of talking in generalities, I think.
And is he a nice guy? Like, aside from the Spurs side, do you get the same sense of warmth from him that we as fans do?
Honestly, yeah. I mean, one journalist who goes quite often to Spurs said to me a few days ago, oh, I actually think I'm getting to like Poch too much as a person, and it's dangerous. Like, genuinely, one of the guys said that. And there was an example earlier this season where, you know, one of the guys had a tragedy in his personal life, and Poch kind of took the time after to talk to him and say how sorry he was. So I think he really is a genuinely warm, nice bloke. I would add that he does keep journalists at arm's length. It's not like we've all got his numbers.
It's not like we go to the pub with him afterwards.
Yeah, it's not like we can, you know, I think in the days of Redknapp and Sherwood, although I wasn't covering the club, and this is just what I've heard, you know, if you weren't sure on something in a press conference, you know, it wasn't inconceivable that you just called up Redknapp afterwards and said, look, just want to clarify.
Yeah. Are you actually signing right now?
Yeah. what are you talking about there? And he would talk to you. It's not like that with Poch, but you know he comes across as very warm, as you said, and I think he does genuinely kind of care about people.
The other thing I'd say about Poch is that he has a lot of credit in the bank with the journalists that cover Spurs. Like, we all like him, we all think that he's a really good manager. And we've all got a bit of a, like Dan said, we're not mates or anything, but we have a bit of rapport with him. And that means that if he, you know, I don't think that mistakes that he might make or would, like, he doesn't really get hammered ever, I think, by the papers. He's got, I think he gets really positive coverage, to be honest.
Yeah, he does. He
not like
does.
It's a, yeah. Not wrongly, but he does.
Mm.
So he has built that credit up, and if he didn't have that, I'm sure the coverage would be really different.
Just that it's in his interest to sort of build that rapport as well in many ways. But I'm sure he's not as cynical as that. I'm sure it's natural because he just comes across as that kind of.
It's human nature as well. I mean, if you see the same people, you know, every week or twice a week, yeah, eventually you are gonna have an understanding with them, and it's not like a really calculated thing to be friendly or to have a bit of a joke.
And would he remember the names of the kind of 15 press guys who were there at the end of a press conference?
That's a good question. I don't know if he knows my name, but he certainly kind of recognises faces.
Yeah,
I agree with Dan.
And I think Perez is the guy who knows absolutely everything. I think he probably knows names, faces, who you work for.
He's the one with the dossier.
Yeah.
Dan wrote a very good piece about Jesus Perez the other day, which, if you're listening, is definitely worth reading.
Oh, thank you.
But he's kind of... I think it's fair to say that Perez takes a more kind of hands-on approach. Like, Perez will read what's written about Tottenham more than Pochettino will be, and then he might flag up to him, have you seen X, Y, or Z?
Mm.
Well, thanks, guys. That was such an interesting hour or so, and we could have gone on longer. There's more I wanted to ask, but that was great. We always end the podcast by doing our further reading section, in which I ask if there's anything, an article, book, or a podcast that you want to recommend, and I'll start off because I've only got one thing, and I'm worried that someone's going to steal it. And just say that
I've the Tottenham way.
No, it's not the Tottenham way. No, you're gonna pick up your own podcast. The piece Dave Heitner did about Eric Lamela, the interview, which I thought was a really, really interesting interview. Went in a completely different direction to what I expected, but it was great and gave a really insight into him as a person and how amusing and ridiculous he found the stories that were going around Twitter about him being on a drug ban. Bardi, how about you?
I've been through a phase of reading a lot of tactics books and history books, but I finally got around to reading A Life Too Short, which is a story about Robert Enke, the German goalkeeper who took his own life, and it's a really deep insight into like how depression can take hold of you, and how this goalkeeper who played for Mourinho and Jupp Heynckes at Benfica ended up at Barcelona, and then within the space of a year was playing second division football in Spain because of crippling depression and anxiety. And it was really, you know, it's not a happy story, but it's a really insightful one and really well written.
Yeah, I mean, I think I agree with Windy. Dave's interview with Eric Lamella was really, really good. Dan's piece about Jesus Perez was really good for Spurs readers. I'm going to be incredibly arrogant and say that I have to recommend our own podcast, the Indie Football Podcast, which comes out every Monday afternoon with me and my colleagues at The Independent.
You enjoying doing that?
Yeah, it's fun. We kind of do it every afternoon, every Monday. So it comes out Monday night, and it's just a kind of look back on the last few days of the Premier League and sort of talking points for the week ahead. We did a bit this time about how we couldn't believe that, in fact, Fernando Llorente has turned out to be even worse than Vincent Janssen.
I really enjoyed the Christmas special of the Tottenham Way, sort of a pub quiz, a bit.
Two Tottenham Way recommendations.
Yeah, it's not Christmas related, it's just it's fun to play along.
Well, thank you. I'm going to recommend Tottenham Way as well. And if you're interested in this kind of podcast that we've just done, I do tend to talk about what Poch says in the press conferences and what the players have said in the mixer, and then try and give a kind of journalistic eye on what's happened at Spurs. Also, I want to recommend a book that I've fairly recently finished called, I think it's called, If You Promise Not to Kiss Me. And it's about, ostensibly about Brian Clough. It's by a journalist called Duncan Hamilton. And it's really about Clough, who I think every football fan should read about anyway, but it's also about how journalism used to be. It's sort of almost slightly depressing to read now as a journalist in this in the modern game, but it's great, and he'll talk about, you know, his relationship with Clough and how it worked as both someone who spent almost every day with Clough as a Nottingham Post, Nottingham Forest reporter, but also someone who had to report on him. And he talks about the bollockings, he talks about driving home from most games with Clough and Peter Taylor, and it's a really, really interesting book about how it used to work as a beat reporter covering one of the biggest clubs at the time, one of the biggest managers in the country, and I couldn't recommend it more.
Awesome. So where can people read more of your content online, Dan?
Dan_KP on Twitter. I don't really do... I do have an Instagram account, Dan Killy P, but I never really go on it.
You don't take photos.
I try and get on Insta, but for now, Dan_KP on Twitter.
And you link to all your content on there, I'm sure.
Yes, yeah.
How about you, Jack?
I'm at Jack Pitbrook on Twitter and at J Pitbrook on Instagram, and you can find most of the rest of my stuff on The Independent.
Cool. And Bardi TFC and yep. Nathan A. Clark, and I'm Windy Coys. Thank you for listening. Hope you've enjoyed it. Do give us feedback and ideas for talking points. We're back in around about a month's time. We've got hopefully another really, really good guest lined up. Just hoping it comes together.
How good are we talking?
Good.
Pretty good. Pretty good. Okay. Yeah, we've got a few in the pipeline. We've got a few people
tricky
in line.
Tricky act to follow, I imagine.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know if you heard, Jack, but you actually made our trailer for The Extra Inch. One of your quotes from the podcast you were on made the trailer, so there you go. But thank you for listening. Please do rate, review on iTunes, and be sure to follow the Twitter feed. It's the Fight In. It's the Fight In. Clock. It's the Fight In. It's the Fight In. Clock. Oh, that was really interesting, mate, yeah.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.